The sisters baked caramel sweets and prepared flasks of cocoa, and even decorated themselves with green and gold ribbons, as if it were a second Lerlinmus. Sarima adorned herself in a brown velvet robe with fur tippets. The children put on extra trousers and tunics, and even Elphaba came along in a thick cloak of purple brocade and heavy Arjiki goatskin boots and mittens, carrying her broom. Chistery lugged along a basket of dried apricots. The sisters, in sensible men's tribal overcoats, belted and latched, drew up the rear. The villagers had cleared the snow off the center of the pond. It was a ballroom dance floor of silver plate, engraved with the flourishes of 1,000 arabesques, mounded round with pillows and bolsters of snow to provide a safe repose for skaters who forget how to break or turn. In the fierce sunlight, the mountains looked razor-sharp against the blue. Great snowy egrets and ice griffins wheeled high above. The ice rink was already noisy with screaming urchins and lurching adolescents, taking every opportunity to tumble and heap each other cozily in suggestive positions. Their elders moved more slowly, processionally around the ice. The crowd fell silent as the household of Kiamo Ko approached, but children being children, the silence didn't last for long. Sarima ventured out onto the ice, her sisters in a knot around her with linked arms. Being largish, Sarima was nervous of falling, nor were her ankles strong. But before long, she had remembered how things went, this foot, then that, long, languorous strides, and the uneasy meeting of social classes was accomplished. Elphaba looked like one of her crows, knees out, elbows flailing, rags flapping, gloved hands raking for balance. After the adults had had enough excitement, but the children were only still warming up, Sarima and the sisters and Elfie collapsed on some bearskins that the citizenry had spread out for them. "In the summer," said Sarima, "we have a huge bonfire and slaughter some pigs before the men descend to the plains, or the boys ascend to the slopes to guard the sheep and the goats. They all come into the castle for a chew of pork and a few tankards of ale. And, of course, any time there's a mountain lion or a particularly nasty bear, we let them into the keep until the beast is killed or wanders away." She smiled with noblesse oblige, in an abbreviated way, off into the middle distance, though the locals were ignoring the castle folk by now. "Auntie dear, you looked quite the sight in that robe, and poking along with that broom." "Weir says it's a magic broom," said Noor, who had run up to throw a handful of granular snowflakes into her mother's face. Elphaba turned her head quickly and tugged her collar up to avoid ricocheting snow spray. Noor laughed unkindly in a beautiful phrase like a woodwind and scampered away. "So tell us how your broom came to be magic," said Sarima. "I never said it was magic. I got it from an elderly Mont named Mother Yackel. She took me under her wing, when she was alert enough, and gave me, well, guidance, I suppose you'd call it."
"Guidance," said Sarima.
"The old Mont said the broom would be my link to my destiny," said Ilfi. I assume she meant that my destiny was domestic, not magic.
"Join the sisterhood," Sarima yawned. "I never knew if Mother Yackel was completely mad or a wise, prophetic old hen," said Elfie, but the others weren't listening, so she lapsed into silence. After a while, Noor came flinging herself into her mother's lap again.
"Tell me a story, Mama," she said. "Those boys are nasty."
"Boys are vexing creatures," agreed her mother. sometimes.
Shall I tell you the story of when you were born?
No, not that, said Noor, yawning.
A wheel story. Tell me about the witch and the fox babies again.
Sarima protested, knowing full well that the children considered Auntie Guest a witch. But Noor was stubborn, and Sarima relented and told the tale. Elphaba listened. Her father had taught her moral precepts, had lectured her about responsibility. Nanny had gossiped. Nessa Rose had whined. But no one had told stories to her when she was young. She pulled herself forward a little so she could hear over the noise of the crowd. Sarima recited the tale with little dramatic involvement, but even so, Elphaba felt a twinge when she heard the conclusion.
And there the wicked old witch stayed for a good long time.
Did she ever come out?
Recited Noor, eyes gleaming with the fun of the ritual.
Not yet, answered Sarima, and leaned forward, pretending to bite Noor on the neck.
Noor squealed and jiggled herself away and ran to rejoin the boys.
I think that's shameful, even if it's just a story, to propose an afterlife for evil, said Elphaba.
Any afterlife notion is a manipulation and a sop. It's shameful the way the Unionists and the Pagans both keep talking up hell for intimidation and the airy other land for reward.
Don't, Sarima said.
For one thing, that's where Fiero is waiting for me.
And you know it.
Elphaba's jaw dropped. When she least expected it, Sarima always seemed ready to rush in with a surprise attack.
"In the afterlife?" said Elfie.
"Oh, what you do take against," said Sarima. "I pity the community of the afterlife when they're asked to welcome you in. What a sour apple you always are."
"She's crazy," said Manic, knowledgeably. "Everyone knows that you can't teach an animal to talk."
They were in the abandoned summer stable, jumping off a loft, making puffs of hay and snow billow in the patchy light.
"Well, what is she doing with Chistri, then?" asked Irji. "If you're so sure of it."
"She's teaching him to mimic like a parrot," said Manic.
"I think she's magic," said Noor.
You think everything's magic," Manic said. "Stupid girl."
"Well, everything is," said Noor, launching herself away from the boys as a further editorial comment on their skepticism.
"Do you really think she's magic?" said Manic to Lear. "You know her better than any of us. She's your mother."
"She's my auntie, isn't she?" Lear said.
"She's our auntie. She's your mother."
"I know," said Irji, pretending full immersion in the topic to avoid another jump. "Lear is Chistri's brother. Lear is what Chistri was like before she taught him how to talk. You're a monkey, Lear."
"I'm not a monkey," said Lear, "and I'm not magic."
"Well, let's go ask Chistri," said Manic. "Is this the day that Auntie has her coffee with Mama? Let's go see if Chistri has learned enough words to answer some questions."
They scampered up the stone spiral staircase to Auntie Witch's apartment. True, she was gone, and there was Chistri nibbling on some nutshells, and Killyjoy dozing by the fire, growling in his sleep, and the bees doing their ceaseless chorus. The children didn't like bees much, nor did they care for Killyjoy. Even Lear had lost interest in the dog once he had children to play with. But Chistri was a favorite.
"Sweet thing, oh, the little baby," said Noor. "Here, you little beast, come to Auntie Noor."
The monkey looked doubtful,
but then on knuckles and capable feet he swung across the floor and vaulted into her arms. He inspected her ears for treats, peered over her shoulders at the boys.
"You tell us, Chistery boy, is Auntie Witch wee wee magic?" said Noor. "Tell us all about Auntie Witch."
"Watch, witch," said Chistery, playing with his fingers. "Which wretch witch?"
They could have sworn it was a question, the way his forehead wrinkled like eyebrows.
"Are you under a spell?" said Manic.
"Spell ill. Spoil spell," answered Chistery. "Spill all."
"How do we spoil the spell? How do we turn you back to a boy?" asked Irgy, the oldest, but just as caught up as the others. "Is there a special way?"
"Why way?" said Chistery. "Wee woo, wee way woe. Why?"
"Tell us what to do," said Noor, petting him.
"Do die," said Chistery.
"Great," said Irgy. "So we can't break the spell you're under?" "Oh, he's only babbling," Elphaba said from the doorway. "Look, I have visitors I didn't even invite."
"Oh, hello, Auntie," they said. They knew they shouldn't be there.
"He's talking, sort of. He's magicked."
"He mostly just repeats what you say," said Elphaba, moving closer. "So leave him alone. You're not allowed here." They said sorry and left. Back in the boys' room, they fell on the mattress and roared until they wept, and couldn't say what was so funny. Maybe it was the relief of having escaped without harm from the witches' rooms, even though they had no business there. The children decided they were no longer scared of Auntie Witch. They were tired of being housebound, but finally it was raining out instead of snowing. They played hide-and-seek a lot, waiting for the rain to lift so they could go outside. One morning, Noor was it. She kept finding Manic easily, because Lear always hid near him and gave him away. Manic lost his patience. "I always get caught, because you're so hopeless. Why can't you hide well?"
"I can't hide in the well," Lear said, misunderstanding.
"Oh, yes, you can," Manic said, delighted. The next round began, and Manic led Lear right down the basement steps. The basement was even damper than usual, with the groundwater seeping through the foundation stones. When they swiveled the lid off the fish well, they could see the water level had risen. But it was still a good 12 or 14 feet down.
"This'll just be fine," Manic said. "Look, if we loop the rope over this hook, the bucket will hold steady enough for you to climb in it. Then, when I let the crank out, the bucket will slowly slide down the side of the well. I'll stop it before it gets to the water, don't worry. Then I'll put the lid on, and Noor will look and look. She'll never find you."
Lear peered into the clammy shaft.
"What if there are spiders?"
"Spiders hate water," said Manic authoritatively. "Don't worry about spiders."
"Why don't you do it?" said Lear.
"You're not strong enough to lower me, that's why," said Manic patiently.
"Don't hide far away," said Lear. "Don't let me down too far. Don't push the cover on all the way. I don't like the dark."
"You're always complaining," Manic said, giving him a hand. "That's why we don't like you, you know."
"Well, everybody's mean to me," Lear said. "Crouch down now. Hold on to the ropes with both hands. If the bucket scrapes against the wall a little bit, just push yourself away. I'll let it down slowly."
"Where are you going to hide?" Lear said. "There isn't any place else in this room."
"I'll hide under the stairs. She'll never find me in the shadows. She hates spiders."
"I thought you said there weren't any spiders."
"She thinks there are," Manic said. One, two, three. This is a really good idea, Lear. You're so brave. He grunted with the effort. Lear was heavier in the bucket than he had figured, and the rope spooled too quickly. It jammed in the joint between the windlass and the struts, and the bucket stopped and smashed against the wall with an echoing thud.
"That was too fast," came Lear's voice, ghostly in the gloom.
"Oh, don't be a sissy," Manic said. "Now, shh, I'm going to pivot the cover back on part way so she won't guess. Don't make any noise."
"I think there's fish down here."
"Of course there are. It's a fish well."
"Well, I'm awfully near the water. Do they jump?"
"Yes, they jump, and they have sharp teeth, you ninny, and they like fat little boys," said Manic. "Of course they don't jump. Would I put you in danger like that if they did? Honestly, you don't trust me at all, do you?" He sighed, as if disappointed beyond words, and when the cover slid all the way on instead of part way, he noted without surprise that Lear was too hurt to complain. Manic hid under the stairs for a little while. When Nor didn't come down, he decided that behind the altar skirts of the old musty chapel would be an even better hiding place.
"Be right back, Lear," he hissed.
But since Lear didn't answer, Manic guessed he was still nursing his grievances. Sarima was taking a rare turn in the kitchen, concocting a stew out of limp vegetables from the keeping room. The sisters were having a dance recital amongst themselves in the music room overhead. "Sounds like a herd of elephants," Sarima said, when Auntie Guest came wandering through, looking for something to snack on. "I didn't expect to see you here," said Elphaba. "You know, I have a complaint to lodge against your children."
"The sweet little vandals. What now?" Sarima said, stirring. "Have they been putting spiders in your bedsheets again?"
"I wouldn't mind spiders. At least the crows could eat them." "No, Sarima. The children rifle through my belongings. They tease Chistery unmercifully, and they will not listen when I talk to them. Can't you do anything with them?"
"What's to be done?" said Sarima. "Here, taste this rutabaga. Is it gone to the dogs?"
"Even Killyjoy wouldn't touch this," decided Elfie. "You better stick with the carrots. I think those children are ungovernable, Sarima. Oughtn't they be off to school?"
"Oh, yes, in a better life they would be, but how can they?" said their mother placidly. "I've already told you that they're sitting targets for ambitious Arjiki tribesmen. It's bad enough even to let them run around on the slopes near Kiamo Ko in the summer. I never know when they're going to be found, trussed and bled like a pig, and brought home for burying. It's the cost of widowhood, Auntie. We must do the best we can."
"I was a good child," Elfie said stoutly. "I took care of my little sister, who was horribly disfigured from birth. I obeyed my father and my mother until she died. I tramped around as a missionary child and gave testimonials to the unnamed God, even though I was essentially faithless. I believed in obedience, and I don't believe it hurt me."
"Then what did hurt you?" asked Sarima wittily.
"You won't listen," said Elfie, "so I won't even say. But for whatever reasons, your children are ungovernable. I disapprove of your lax ways."
"Oh, children are good at heart," Sarima said, intent on scraping carrots. "They are so innocent and gay. It cheers me up to see them dashing about the house in this game or that. All too soon these precious days will be past, dear Auntie, and then we will look back on when this house was filled with peals of childish laughter."
"Fiendish laughter!"
"There is something inherently good about children," said Sarima decidedly, warming to the subject. "You know that little Ozma, who all those years ago was deposed by the wizard. They say that she is off someplace, frozen in a cave, perhaps even in the Kells, for all I know. She's preserved in her childhood innocence, because the wizard hasn't the courage to kill her. One day she'll come back to rule Oz, and she'll be the best and wisest sovereign we ever had, because of the wisdom of youth.
I've never believed in child saviors, Elphaba said. As far as I'm concerned, children are the ones who need saving.
You're just cross because the children have such high spirits.
Your children are evil sprites, Elphie said in a snit.
My children aren't evil, nor were my sisters and I evil children.
Your children aren't good, said Elphie.
Well, how do you judge Lear in this regard, then?
Oh, Lear, Elphie said, and made an expression, and said fa with her tongue and hands. Sarima was about to pursue this, a matter she had long been curious about, when three came rushing into the kitchen.
"The passes below us must have melted sooner than usual," she said, "for we have sighted a caravan struggling its way over the Loch Lim Trail, coming from the north. It'll be here by tomorrow."
"Oh, rapture!" Sarima said. "And the castle such a mess! This always happens. Why don't we learn? Quick, call the children, and we'll have to organize a scrub and polish. You never know, Auntie. It could be an honored guest. You have to be prepared."
Manek and Noor and Irji came running from their game. Three told them the news, and they immediately had to dash up the highest tower to see what they could see through the slackening rain, and to wave aprons and handkerchiefs. Yes, there was a caravan, 5 or 6 skarks and a small wagon, pulling through the snow and the mud, having trouble fording this stream, stopping to mend a split wheel, stopping to feed the skarks. It was a wonderful treat, and all through the dinner meal of vegetable soup, the children chattered away at the surprises they might find among the passengers in the caravan.
"They've never stopped thinking their father is going to come back," said Sarima under her breath to Elphaba. "This excitement is a hope for him, though they don't remember it."
"Where is Lear?" asked Four. "It's a perfect waste of good soup when he doesn't show up on time. He shan't get any if he comes whining to me afterward. Children, where is Lear?"
"He was playing with us earlier. Maybe he fell asleep," said Irji.
"Let's go set a bonfire and smoke the travellers a hello," said Manek, leaping from the table.
It was lunchtime when the skarks and the wagon began the final, difficult ascent up the slope to the castle portcullis and the gates of jasper and oak. The townspeople came out from their hovels and leaned their weight against the carriage, helping it through the ruts of mud and ice, until at last it turned in and crossed the open drawbridge. Elphaba, her curiosity as piqued as anyone else's, stood with the Dowager Princess of the Arjikis and her sisters on a parapet above the crudely carved front doorway. The children waited in the cobblestoned yard below, all but Lear. The leader, a grizzled young man, made the faintest mountain obeisance to Sarima. The skarks defecated sloppily on the cobbles, to the delight of the children, who had never seen skark fumets before. Then the leader went to the cabin and opened the door and climbed inside. They could hear his voice raised loudly, as if talking to someone hard of hearing. They waited. The sky was a piercing blue, really almost a spring blue, and the icicles hung from the eaves in dangerous daggers, melting like mad. The sisters all sucked in their stomachs, cursing the extra piece of gingerbread, the honeyed cream and the coffee, vowing to do better. "Please, sweet Lurlina, let it be a man." The leader came out again and proffered a hand, and he helped a figure alight from the cabin, an old, creaky-limbed figure in sad, dark skirts and a hideously outfashioned bonnet, even from the provincial point of view. But Elphaba was leaning forward, cleaving the air with her sharp chin and hatchet nose, and sniffing like a beast. The visitor turned, and the sun struck her face.
"Good glory," breathed Elfie. "It's my old nanny."
And she left the parapet to run and gather the old woman in her arms.
"Human feeling, will you look at that?" said Four sniffily. "I wouldn't have guessed her capable."
For Auntie Guest was all but sobbing with pleasure. The caravan leader wouldn't stay for a meal, but Nanny, with her valises and trunks, clearly did not intend to go any farther. She settled in a small, musty room just below Elphaba's and took the endless time it takes the elderly to make her toilet. By the time she was ready to be sociable, dinner was served. A gamey old hen, more rope than flesh, lay in a thin pepper sauce on one of the good salvers. The children were dressed in their best, and allowed this once to dine in the formal hall. Nanny came in on the arm of Elphaba, and sat at her right hand. Because this was a visitor to Elfie, the sisters had kindly put Elfie's napkin ring at the foot of the table, opposite Sarima, a place by custom left vacant in honor of poor dead Fihiro. It was a big mistake, and they would recognize it almost immediately, as Elphaba never relinquished her advancement. But for now, all was smiles and savory hospitality. The only small annoyance, besides that Nanny wasn't a young, eligible princeling looking for a bride, was that Lear still conducted his campaign of sullen disappearance. The children didn't know where he was. Nanny was a tired and fruity old woman, skin cracked like dried soap, hair thin and yellowy-white, hands with veins as prominent as the cords around a good Arjiki goat cheese. She communicated wheezily, with lots of pauses to breathe and think, that she had heard through someone named Crope in the Emerald City that her old charge, Elphaba, had attended Tibbet in his last days at the cloister of St. Glinda outside the Emerald City. No one in the family had heard from Elphaba in years and years, and Nanny had decided to take it upon herself to find her. The Monts were reluctant at first, but Nanny had persisted, and then she had waited until a new caravan was ready to leave. The Monts had told her about Elphaba's mission in Kiamo Ko, and Nanny had booked passage the following spring, and here she was. "And of the outside world?" asked Two eagerly. "Let them catch up on family gossip on their own time."
"What do you mean?" said Nanny.
"Politics, science, fashion, the arts, the driving edge," said Two.
"Well, our redoubtable wizard has crowned himself emperor," said Nanny. "Did you know that?"
They hadn't heard.
"By whose authority?" asked Five, scoffing. "And furthermore, emperor over what?" "There isn't anyone who has any more authority," he said Nanny calmly. "And who could argue with that? He's in the business of handing out honors annually as it is. He just tacked on an extra one for himself. As for emperor over what, I couldn't say. Some people whisper that this implies expansionist aims. But where he could expand to, I couldn't say. I just couldn't. Into the desert? Beyond? To Quox? Or Ix? Or Fleon?
Or does he mean to have a more tight-fisted hold on terrain he's only loosely governed?" asked Elphaba. "Like the Vincas?" She felt a chill, like an old wound deep beneath her breastbone.
"No one is particularly happy," said Nanny. "There is an enforced conscription now, and the gale force threatens to outnumber the Royal Army. One doesn't know if there could be an internal struggle for power, and the wizard is preparing against an eventual takeover attempt. How can one have an opinion about such things, old and female as we are?"
She smiled to include them all. The sisters and Sarima glared as youthfully as they could back at her. The next day hardly dawned at all, so gloomy with rain, so glowery with featureless clouds. In the parlor, waiting for Nanny to emerge and continue her obligation of entertaining them, the sisters and Sarima discussed what new facts they had learned about their auntie guest.
"Elphaba," mused Two. "It's a pretty enough name. Where does it come from?"
"I remember," said Five, who had once gone through a faintly religious phase when she realized marriage possibilities were growing dim. "I had a Lives of the Saints once. Saint Elphaba of the Waterfall. She was a Munchkinlander mystic 6 or 7 centuries ago. Don't you remember? She wanted to pray, but she was of such beauty that the local men kept pestering her for attention." They all sighed in chorus. "To preserve her sanctity, she went into the wilderness with her holy scriptures and a single bunch of grapes. Wild beasts threatened her, and wild men hunted after her, and she was sore distressed. Then she came upon a huge waterfall coursing off a cliff. She said, 'This is my cave,' and took off all her clothes, and she walked right through the screen of pounding water. Beyond was a cavern hollowed out by the splashing water. She sat down there, and in the light that came through the wall of water, she read her holy book and pondered on spiritual matters. She ate a grape every now and then. When at last she had finished her grapes, she emerged from the cave. Hundreds of years had passed. There was a village built on the banks of the stream, and even a mill dam nearby. The villagers shrank in horror, for as children they had all played in the cavern behind the waterfall. Lovers had trysted there. Murders and foul deeds had taken place there. Treasure had been buried there. And never had anyone ever seen Saint Elphaba in her naked beauty. But all Saint Elphaba had to do was open her mouth and speak the old speech, and they all knew that it must be she, and they built a chapel in her honor. She blessed the children and the elderly, and heard the confessions of the middle-aged, and healed some sick and fed some hungry, that sort of stuff, and then disappeared behind the waterfall again with another bunch of grapes, I think a bigger bunch this time, and that's the last anyone has seen of her."
"So you can disappear and not be dead," said Sarima, looking out the window a little dreamily, past the rain.
"If you're a saint," said Two pointedly.
"If you even believe it," said Elphaba, who had come into the parlor during the end of the recitation. "The re-emerging Saint Elphaba might have been some hussy from the next town over who wanted to give gullible peasants a good going over."
"That's doubt for you. It scours hope out of everything," Sarima said dismissively. "Auntie, you kill me sometimes, you really do."
"I think it would be charming to call you Elphaba," said Six, "because that is a charming story, and it's nice to hear your real name on Nanny's lips."
"Don't you try it," said Elfie. "If Nanny can't help herself, so be it. She's ancient, and it's hard to change, but not you."
Six pursed her lips as if to make an argument, but just then there was a clattering of feet from downstairs, and Nor and Irgy burst into the room.
"We found Lear," they said. "Come on, we think he's dead. He's fallen in the fish well."
They all pounded down the stairs to the basement. Chistery had been the one to find him. The snow monkey's nose had wrinkled, when he and the boys passed the fish well, and he had whined and whimpered and tugged at the weighted cover. Nor and Irgy had had an idea to lower him down in the bucket then, but when they swiveled the cover off, the lurid gleam of light on pale human flesh had terrified them. Manic came running when he heard the noise of his mother and the others exclaiming before the well. They pulled Lear up. The water had risen, what with continued melting and the further rain. Lear was like a corpse left in a stream, bloated.
"Oh, is that where he was?" said Manic in a funny voice. "You know, he said he wanted to go down in that fish well once."
"Get away, children. You shouldn't see this. Go upstairs," Sarima said, scolding. "Come on now, behave. Upstairs for you." They didn't know what they were looking at, and they were afraid to look too closely.
"I cannot believe it. This is so terrible," said Manic excitedly, and Elphaba gave him a sharp, hateful look.
"Obey your mother," she snapped, and Manic made a nasty face, but he and Irgy and Nor clumped upstairs and huddled around the open doorway at the top to listen and peer.
"Oh, who has the art of medicine in their hands? Have you, Auntie?" asked Sarima. "Quick now, there may be time. You have the arts, don't you? You studied the life sciences. What can you do?"
"Irgy, go get Nanny. Tell her it's an emergency," shouted Elfie. "We'll bring him up to the kitchen, gently now." "No, Sarima, I don't know enough."
"Use your spells. Use your magic," exclaimed Five.
"Bring him back," urged Six. And Three added, "You can do it. Don't be hidden and shy about it now."
"I can't bring him back," said Elphaba. "I can't. I have no aptitude for sorcery. I never did. That was all a foolish campaign of Madame Morrible's, which I rejected."
The six sisters looked at her askance. Irgy escorted Nanny to the kitchen. Nor brought the broom. Manic brought the grimmery. And the sisters and Sarima brought the body of Lear, dripping and bloated, and laid him on the butcher's block.
"Oh, now, who's this one?" mused Nanny,
but got to work pumping the legs and the arms, and set Sarima to pressing in at the abdomen. Elphaba flipped through the grimmery. She screwed up her face and hit herself on the temple with her fists, and wailed,
"But I have no personal experience with a soul. How can I find his if I don't know what one looks like?"
"He's even fatter than usual," said Irgy. "If you prick his eyes out with a magic straw from the magic broom, his soul will come back," said Manic.
"I wonder why he went in the fish well," said Nor. "I never would." "Holy Lurlina, mercy on us, mercy," said Sarima, weeping,
and the sisters began to mumble the service of the dead, honoring the unnamed god for the life departed.
"Nanny can't do everything," snapped Nanny. "Elphaba, be some help. You're just like your mother in a crisis. Put your mouth on his and push air into his lungs. Go on."
Elphaba wiped the wet off Lear's pasty face with the edge of her sleeve. The face stayed where it was pushed. She grimaced and nearly vomited and spit something into a bucket, and then she sank her mouth down on the child's and breathed out, pushing into the sour passage her own sour breath. Her fingers tensed at the sides of the butcher's block, gouging splinters as if in an ecstasy of sexual tension. Chistery breathed along with her, breath for breath.
"He smells like fish," Nor said under her breath. "If that's what you look like when you drown, I'd rather burn to death," said Irgy.
"I'm just not going to die," Manic said, "and nobody can make me."
The body of Lear began to choke. They thought at first it was an involuntary reaction, air from Elphaba's mouth, pocketing and blurting out again. and then there was a small stream of yellowish yuck. Then Lear's eyelids moved, and his hand twitched of its own accord.
"Oh, mercy!" Sarima murmured. "It's a miracle. Thank you, Lurlina. Bless you."
"We're not out of the woods yet," said Nanny. "He may still die of exposure. Quick now, off with his clothes."
The children watched the silly indignity of grown-up women tearing stupid Lear's trousers and tunic off. They rubbed him all over with lard. This gave the children a case of the giggles, and made Irgi feel very funny in his trousers for the first time in his life. Then they wrapped Lear in a woolen blanket, which made quite a mess, and prepared to put him to bed.
"Where does he sleep?" said Sarima.
They all looked at one another. The sisters looked at Elphaba, and Elphaba looked at the children.
"Oh, sometimes on the floor in our room, sometimes on the floor in Nor's," said Manik. "He wants to sleep in my bed, too, but I push him out," said Nor. "He's too fat. There'd be no room for me in my dowies."
"He doesn't even have a bed?" Sarima coldly asked Elfie.
"Well, don't ask me. This is your house," said Elfie.
And Lear stirred somewhat and said,
"The fish talked to me. I talked to the fish. The goldfish talked to me. She said she was..."
"Hush, little one," said Nanny. "Time for that later."
She glared around at the women and children in the kitchen.
"Well, it shouldn't take Nanny to have to find him a proper bed, but if there's none other for him, he can come up to my room and I'll sleep on the floor."
"Of course not. The very idea," began Sarima, bustling ahead.
"Barbarians, the lot of you!"
snapped Nanny, for which no one in Kiamoko ever forgave her. Sarima lectured Auntie Guest severely for what had happened to Lear. Elphaba tried to say that it was not her doing, it was not her fault.
"It was some boy's trick, some game, some dare," she said.
Their accusations spent, they fell to talking about the differences between boys and girls. Sarima told Auntie Guest what she knew of the boy's initiation rite in the tribe. "They are taken out in the grasslands and left with nothing but a loincloth and a musical instrument. They are required to call forth spirits and animals out of the night, to converse with them, to learn from them, to soothe them if they need soothing, to fight them if they need fighting. The child who dies at night clearly lacks the discretion to decide if its company needs fighting or soothing. So it is correct that he should die young and not burden the tribe with his foolishness."
"What do the boys say of spirits who approach them?" asked Auntie Guest.
"Boys say very little, especially about the spirit world," she answered. "Nonetheless, you pick up what you pick up, and I think some of the spirits are very patient, very wearing, very obdurate. The lore supposes there should be conflict, hostility, battle. But I wonder, in contact with spirits, if what the boy needs is a good helping of cold anger."
"Cold anger?"
"Oh, yes. Don't you know that distinction? Tribal mothers always tell their children that there are two kinds of anger, hot and cold. Boys and girls experience both, but as they grow up, the angers separate according to the sex. Boys need hot anger to survive. They need the inclination to fight, the drive to sink the knife into the flesh, the energy and initiative of fury. It's a requirement of hunting, of defense, of pride, maybe of sex, too."
"Yes, I know," said Elphaba, remembering.
Sarima blushed and looked unhappy, and continued. "And girls need cold anger. They need the cold simmer, the ceaseless grudge, the talent to avoid forgiveness, the sidestepping of compromise." They need to know when they say something that they will never back down, ever, ever. It's the compensation for a more limited scope in the world. Cross a man and you struggle. One of you wins, you adjust and go on, or you lie there dead. Cross a woman, and the universe is changed once again, for cold anger requires an eternal vigilance in all matters of slight and offense. She glared at Elphaba, pinning her with unspoken accusations about Fiero, about Lear. Elphaba thought about this. She thought about hot anger and cold anger, and if it divided by the sexes, and which she felt, if either, if ever. She thought about her mother dying young, and her father with his obsessions. She thought about the anger that Dr. Dillamond had, an anger that drove him to study and research. She thought about the anger that Madame Morrible could barely disguise, as she tried to seduce the college girls into the secret service of government. She sat and thought about it the following morning, as she watched the strengthening sun beat down on the mounds of snow on the sloping tiled roofs below. She watched the sun bleed ice water out of the icicle, warm and cold working together to make an icicle, warm and cold anger working together to make a fury worthy enough to use as a weapon against the old things that still needed fighting. In a fashion, without any way to confirm it, of course, she had always felt as capable of hot anger as any man. But to be successful, one would need access to both sorts. Lear survived, but Manic did not. The icicle that Elphaba trained her gaze on, thinking on the weapons one needed to fight such abuse, it broke like a lance from the eaves and drove whistling downward and caught him in the skull as he went out to find some new way of beleaguering Lear. Uprisings.
"They're calling you a witch. Do you know that?" said Nanny. "Now, why ever is that?"
"Silliness and stupidity," said Elphaba. "When I arrived, I was distanced from my name after my years at the Monterey, where I was called Sister Saint Elphaba. Elphaba seemed like the name of someone long ago. I told them to call me Auntie, though I never felt like anyone's auntie, nor would I know what it felt like. I never had any aunts or uncles."
"Hmm," said Nanny. "I don't think you're much of a witch. Your mother would be scandalized, bless her soul. Your father, too."
They were walking in the apple orchard. A cloud of blossoms thickened the air with scent. The witch's bees were having a field day, humming throatily. Killyjoy sat wagging his tail in the shadow of Manic's tombstone, placed near the wall. The crows had relay races overhead, scaring away all other birds except the eagles. Irgi and Nor and Lear, at Nanny's insistence, had been taken into the schoolroom of the village. Kiamo Ko was blissfully quiet until midday. Nanny was 78. She walked with a cane. She hadn't given up on her little efforts toward beauty, though now they seemed to coarsen rather than dignify her. Her powder was on too thick, her lip rouge smeared and off-center, and the flimsy lace shawl was useless in the updraft from the valley. For her part, Nanny thought that Elphaba was looking poorly, as if she were going moldy from the inside out. Pale, a disintegration of sorts. Elphaba didn't seem to care for her beautiful hair at all, keeping it knotted up out of sight underneath that ridiculous hat. And the black gown needed a good washing and airing. They stopped at a lopsided wall and leaned against it. The sisters were gathering flowers a few fields away, and Sarima ballooned along. In her dark morning gown, she resembled a huge, dangerous cocoon broken loose from its mooring. It was good to hear her laugh again, even if falsely. Light had that strange, ameliorative effect on everybody, even Elphaba. Nanny had told Elfie about her family. The eminent Throp had died at last. In Elphaba's absence and presumed death, the mantle of eminence had fallen to Nessa Rose. So the younger sister was now ensconced in Colwyn grounds, issuing dogmatic statements about faith and blame. Frex was there with her, too, his career of ministry almost at an end. As he gave up the effort, his mind was returning to balance. Shell, he came and went. Rumors abounded that he was an agitator for Munchkinland's secession from Oz. He had grown up handsome and fine, in Nanny's biased opinion. Straight of limb, clear of skin, direct of speech, bold of heart. He was now in his early 20s. "And what does Nessa Rose think of secession?" Elfie had asked. "Her opinion about it will be important if she's the eminent Throp now." Nanny reported that Nessa Rose had grown to be far cleverer than anyone anticipated. She kept her cards close to her chest and issued vague statements about the revolutionary cause, statements that could be read several ways, depending on the audience. Nanny assumed Nessa Rose intended to set up some sort of theocracy, incorporating into the governing laws of Munchkinland her own restrictive interpretation of unionism. "Your sainted father, Frex himself, doesn't know if this would be a good or bad thing, and keeps silent on the matter. He's not much for politics. He prefers the mystical realm." There was, Nanny observed, even some local support for Nessa Rose's plans. But since Nessa Rose governed her remarks well, the wizard's armed forces garrisoned in the area could find no excuse to arrest her. "She's adept at this," Nanny admitted. "She has taught her well. She stands on her own 2 feet now." The word adept sent chills down Elfie's spine. Was Nessa Rose even now responding to some sort of spell that Madame Morrible had placed on her, those foggy years ago in the parlor at Craige Hall? Was she in fact a pawn, an adept of the wizard, or of Madame Morrible? Did she know why she did what she did? For that matter, was Elphaba herself merely a playing piece of a higher evil power? The recollection of Madame Morrible's proposals for their careers, hers and Nessa Rose's and Glinda's, had come back to Elfie with a shock following the recovery of Lear from his saturation and near drowning last winter. When he finally came around enough to answer questions about how he had come to be in the fish well, he could only say, "The fish talked to me. She told me to come down." Elfie knew in her heart that it was Manic, horrible, evil Manic, who had tortured the boy unmercifully and openly all winter. She didn't care that Manic died, even if Manic was the precious son of Fiero. Any torturer was fair game for javelin icicles. But she had to pause, gulping, at what Lear had said next. He said, "The fish told me she was magic. She said that Fiero was my father, and that Irgi and Manic and Nor are my brothers and my sister." "Goldfish don't talk, sweetheart," Sarima said. "You're imagining things. You were down there too long, and your brain got waterlogged." Elphaba had yearned toward Lear, a strange, unhappy compulsion. Who was this boy who lived in her life? Oh, she knew more or less where he came from, but who he was, it seemed to make a difference for the first time in her life. She had reached out and put her hand on his shoulder. He had twitched it off. He was not used to such a gesture, and she had felt rebuffed.
"'Want to see my pet mouse, Weir?' said Noor, who had been warm to the boy during his convalescence.
Lear always chose the company of his peers over questioning by the grown-ups, and it was impossible to pry further information out of him about his ordeal. He didn't seem much changed, except that with Manic dead, Lear charged around Kiamo Ko with greater zest and liberty. And Sarima had looked at Elphaba, and Elphaba thought the hour of her liberation was at hand at last.
"'How silly of the boy! He's delusional,' Sarima had said at last. "'The idea of Fiero being his father. Fiero didn't have an ounce of fat on his body, and look at the boy!'
Under the terms of her welcome, Elphaba could not prod Sarima to change her mind, but she stared at her hostess, willing her to accept the facts. But she wouldn't.
"'And whoever might the mother be,' said Sarima blandly, touching the hem of her skirt softly. "'It's preposterous beyond words.'
For the first time, Elfie wished that Lear had at least an undertone of green in his skin. Sarima had swept away to weep in her chapel for her husband, for her second son. And the terms of Elfie's imprisonment, as an unwilling traitor, as an exiled Mont, as a hapless mother, as a failed insurrectionist, as a witch in disguise, remained unchanged. Though the idea of a goldfish or a carp in the fish well telling such things to Lear, was there any possibility in that? Or had Madame Morrible the ability to change her shape, to live in cold darkness, to slip in and observe what Elfie was up to? Lear had no imagination to speak of. He couldn't have come up with that by himself, could he? When she went to look in the fish well, many times, at all hours of the day or night, the old carp, or carp, stayed out of sight.
"'I'm glad to hear Nessa Rose is on her 2 feet,' said Elphaba at last, coming back to the orchard from her musings. Nanny was gnawing at a piece of sugar candy. "'I mean that literally, you know,' said Nanny through her spittle. "'She doesn't need to be propped up any more, not figuratively or literally. She can stand on her own, stand and sit.' "'Without benefit of arms?' "'I don't believe it,' said the witch. "'You'll have to. Do you remember that pair of shoes that Frex had decorated for her?' "'Of course Elphaba remembered. The beautiful shoes. Her father's sign of devotion to his second daughter.' His desire to accentuate her beauty and draw attention away from her deformity. "'Well, old Glinda of the Arduenas, remember her? Married to Sir Chuffrey, and gone a bit to seed, in my humble opinion. She came to Colwyn Grounds a couple of years ago. She and Nessa Rose had a wild old time remembering college days, and she put those very same shoes through something of an enchantment.' Don't ask me. Magic was never my cup of tea. The shoes allowed Nessa Rose to sit and stand and walk without support. She is never without them. She claims they give her moral virtue, too, but then she has buckets more of that than she needs. You'd be surprised how superstitious Munchkinlanders have become these days. Nanny sighed. That's why I was free to look you up, dearie. The magic shoes made me redundant. Nanny is out of a job.
"'You're too old to work. You sit and enjoy the sun,' said Elphaba. "'You can stay here as long as you like.'
"'You talk as if this is your house,' said Nanny, "'as if you have the right to issue such invitations.'
"'Until I'm allowed to leave, this is my house,' said Elfie. "'I can't help it.' Nanny shaded her eyes and looked out over the mountains, which in the midday light looked like polished horn.
It's too rich. To think of you being a witch, after a fashion anyway, and your sister trying out as resident saint. Who would have thought, back in those muddy years in the Quaddling Badlands? I don't think you're a witch, whatever you say, but one thing I do want to know. Is Lear your son?
Elphaba shivered, though her heart, deep inside its pocket of cold, roiled in hot energy.
"It is not a question I can answer," she said sadly. "You needn't keep anything from me, dearie. Remember, Nanny was nursemaid to your mother, too, and a more outgoing, sensual woman I have yet to meet. Convention didn't bind her, not in youth nor in married life."
"I don't think I want to hear about this," said Elfie.
"Then let's talk about Lear. What in blazes can you mean you can't answer a simple question like that? Either you conceived him and bore him, or you didn't. As far as I know, in this world, there are no other stories."
"What I mean," said Elphaba, "and the only remark about it I will ever make, is this. When I first went to the Monterey under the kind offices of Mother Yackel, I was in no state to know what was happening to me, and I spent about a year in a deathly sleep. It's just possible I brought a child to term and delivered it. I was another full year recovering. When I was first assigned duties, I worked with the sick and the dying, and also with abandoned children. I had no more congress with Lear than with any other of several dozen brats. When I left the Monterey to come here, it was under the condition that I would take Lear with me. I didn't question the instruction. One doesn't question the instructions of superiors. I have no motherly warmth toward the boy." She gulped, in case this was no longer true. "And I don't feel as if I've ever gone through the experience of bearing a child. I don't quite believe myself capable, in fact, although I'm willing to concede that this may be simply ignorance and blindness. But that's all there is to say about it. I'll say no more, and no more will you."
"Have you an obligation to be motherly to him, then, despite the mystery?"
"The only other obligations I'm under are the ones I assign to myself, and that, Nanny, is that."
"You are too tart. This situation makes you unhappy. But if you think I came here to raise yet another generation of throps, forget it. Nanny is in her senility now, remember, and happily so."
But Elphaba couldn't help noting that in the weeks that followed, Nanny began to attend to Lear's needs more lovingly than she did the needs of Nor and Irgy. Elphaba registered it with shame, for she also saw how willingly Lear responded to Nanny's attention. In telling tales of Shell's derring-do, her racy old heart pitter-pattering almost visibly beneath her breastbone, Nanny revealed details of the wizard's campaigns. It made Elphaba furious, for she had kept hoping to lose interest in the ways of evil men. Nanny buzzed on about the wizards having mounted a new kind of youth camp, the Emperor's Garden, a pretty euphemistic name. All Munchkinlander children from 4 to 10 were required to attend in month-long summer residences. The children were sworn to secrecy, a great game for them, no doubt. Nanny told a long-winded tale more suited to toothless cronies in a fireside ingle nook than to a dinner table with upright and repressed Arjiki spinsters, of how Shell, dear stranger brother Shell, disguised himself as a potato man doing deliveries, and got in the gates. Oh, la, the many amusing adventures of a rake! The camp general's newbuild daughter in Dezabille, Shell's inventive alibis, his dalliances, his narrow escapes, almost being discovered at his liaisons by children. What a lark! Nanny remained a mouthy old peasant at heart, despite her airs. Elphaba thought, she hardly comprehends. She is talking about indoctrination, betrayal, forced conscription of children into low-level warfare. With Elfie's newfound awareness of Lear hovering at the edges of her life, bumbling gently through her days, she found these tales of indoctrinated children horrifying and repugnant. She went to the Grimmery and hauled open its massive cover, leather ornamented with golden hasps and pins and tooled with silver leaf, and pored through the tome to find what makes people thirst for such authority and muscle. Is it the sheer nature of the beast within, the human animal inside the human being? She looked for a recipe for the overthrow of a regime. She found much on power and damage, but little on strategy. The Grimmery described poisoning the lips of goblets, charming the steps of a staircase to buckle, agitating a monarch's favorite lapdog to make a fatal bite in an unwelcome direction. It suggested the nocturnal insertion, through any convenient orifice, of a fiendish invention, a thread like a piano wire, part tapeworm and part burning fuse, for a particularly painful demise. All of this seemed carnival sleight of hand to Elphaba. What was more interesting in her reading was a small drawing she saw next to a section marked Evil Particulars. The drawing, done, if you would believe gullible Sarima, in some world other than theirs, was a clever sketch of a broad-faced woman fiend. Written in an angular, bronchiating script with elegant tapering serifs, all around the illustration were the words, "Yackle snarling." Elphaba looked again. She saw a creature part woman, part grassland jackal, its jaws open, its hand paw lifted to rip the heart out of a spider web. And the creature reminded her of old Mother Yackal from the Monterey. Conspiracy theories, as Sarima had said, seemed to bedevil her thinking. She turned the page. Nothing in the Grimmery on how to depose a tyrant, nothing useful. Armies of holy angels were not answerable to her. Nothing there that described why men and women could turn out so horrible, or so wonderful, if that ever happened anymore. In truth, the family was devastated over Manic's death. There was an unspoken feeling that somehow Lear's life had been saved at the expense of Manic's. The sisters suffered from that most dreadful of losses, the theft of the adult Manic from their lives. Their sad lot had been bearable all these years because Manic was going to be the man Fiero had been, and maybe more. They realized in retrospect that they had expected Manic to restore the fallen fortunes of Kiamo Ko. Feckless Irji had no more sense of destiny than a prairie dog, and nor was a girl more flighty and distractible than usual. So Sarima, behind her gestures of ecstatic acceptance of life, its joys, its sorrows, its mysteries, as she was fond of elaborating, became more aloof. Never close to her sisters, she began to take her meals alone in the solar. Irji and Noor, who had enjoyed a sort of allegiance from time to time against the headstrong malice of Manic, had less to bind them together now. Irji began to moon about in the old Unionist chapel, teaching himself to read better by scrutinizing moldy hymnals and breviaries. Nor didn't like the chapel. She thought the ghost of Manic lingered there, as that was the last place she had seen his body in the unwrapped shroud. So she tried to ingratiate herself with Auntie Witch, but to no avail. "You are out to make mischief with Chistery," snapped Elfie, "and I've work to do. Go bother someone else." She aimed a kick at Noor, who, whimpering and screaming as if it had hit home, left in a funk. nor took to wandering, now that the summer was coming in, down the high valley, the one with the stream at its bottom, and up the other side where the sheep were nibbling on the best grass they would get all year. In previous years, she would either have been with her brothers, or she would have been forbidden to go climbing alone. This year, no one was paying enough attention to her to forbid it. She wouldn't have minded being forbidden. She wouldn't have minded the strap, even. She was lonely. One day, she wandered particularly far down the valley, luxuriating in the strength and endurance of her strong legs. She was only 10, but a strapping, mature 10. She had hiked her green skirt up into her belt, and because the sun was high and strong, she had shucked off her blouse and tied it like a bandana around her head. She hardly had a swelling here or there on her chest with which to startle any sheep, and anyway she expected to be able to spot a shepherd from miles away. "How in the world did I come to be here, of all places in Oz?" she asked herself, freshly treading upon the terrain of reflection. "Here I am, a girl on a mountain, nothing but wind and sheep and grass, like an emerald brush fire, green and golden as lurleenmas decorations, silky in the updraft, coarse in the downdraft. Just me and the sun and the wind. And that group of soldiers coming out from behind the rock." She slid down onto her back in the grass, fixed up her blouse, and raised herself to her elbows, hiding. They were not soldiers such as she had seen before. They were not Arjiki men in their ceremonial brasses and helmets, with their spears and shields. These were men in brown uniforms and caps, with muskets or something slung over their shoulders. They were wearing a kind of boot, rather high and inappropriate for hill-walking, and when one of them had stopped and was fiddling with a nail or a stone in his boot, his arm disappeared inside it right up to his elbow. There was a green stripe down the front of their uniforms and a bar across it, and Nor felt cold with an unfamiliar sense of anticipation. At the same time, she wanted to be seen. What would Manik have done? She asked herself. Irgi would run, Lear would puzzle and dither, but Manik? Manik would have marched right up to them and found out what was going on. And so would she. She checked once again to make sure her buttons were done up, and then she strode down the slope toward them. By the time she had got all their attention, and the man with the boot had slipped it back on, she was beginning to rethink the wisdom of the plan. But it was too late to run away now. "Hail!" she said in a formal way, using the language of the East, not her own Arjiki vernacular. "Hail and halt! I am the princess daughter of the Arjikis, and this is my valley you're marching your big black boots along." It was broad noon when she delivered them into the castle keep of Kiamo Ko. The sisters were in their summer laundry yard, beating carpets themselves because they didn't trust the local scrub-wives to treat them respectfully enough. The sound of boots on cobbles brought the sisters running through an archway, all flushed and dusty, their hair wrapped in cotton scarves. Elphaba heard the noise, too, and threw her window open and stared. "Not an inch farther until I come down," she called, "or I'll turn you all to rodents. Nor, come away from them. All of you, come away."
"I shall fetch the Dowager Princess," said Tu, "if it please you, gentlemen."
But by the time Sarima arrived, drowsy from a nap, Elphaba had descended, her broom over her shoulder, her eyebrows up to her scalp.
"You have no invitation here," said Elfie,
looking more like a witch than ever in her montish skirts.
"So just how welcome would you like to be made? Who is in charge here? You? Who's the senior one leads this mission? You?"
"If you please, madam," said someone,
a strapping Gilikinese man of about 30.
I am the commander. The name is Cherry Stone, and I'm under the Emperor's orders to requisition a house large enough to shelter our party while we are in this district of the Kells. We are doing a survey of the passes to the Thousand-Year Grasslands. He produced a sweat-stained document from inside his shirt.
"I found them, Auntie Witch," said Noor proudly.
"Go away, go inside," said Elphaba to the girl. "You men aren't welcome here, and the girl has no right to invite you. Turn around and march yourself out over that drawbridge at once."
Noor's face fell.
"This is not a request, it is an order," said Commander Cherrystone in an apologetic tone.
"This isn't a suggestion, it's a warning," said Elphaba. "Go or suffer the consequences."
Sarima by now had taken in enough to step forward, her sisters buzzing in a thrill around her.
"Auntie Guest," she said, "you forget the code of the mountains, the same code by which you came to lodge here, and your old nanny after you. We do not turn visitors away. Please, sirs, excuse our excitable friend, and excuse us. It has been some time since we saw soldiers in uniform." The sisters were primping away as best they could at such short notice.
"I won't have it, Sarima," Elphaba said. "You've never been out of here. You don't know who these men are or what they will do. I won't have it, do you hear?"
"It's the high spirits, the determination. It makes her so much fun to have around," said Sarima a little meanly, as in general she really did enjoy Elphaba's company. But she did not like having her authority usurped.
"Gentlemen, this way. I'll show you where you can wash up."
Irji wasn't sure what to make of military men, and wouldn't go very near. Whether he was afraid of being conscripted or enchanted, he couldn't say. He dragged a sleeping roll down into the chapel and slept there, now that it was warm enough. It was Nanny's opinion he was going weird.
"Believe me, after a life looking after your dear mother's devout husband, Frex, and your sister after that, I know a religious lunatic when I see one," she said to Elphaba. "That boy ought to be taking some lessons from these men in manliness, whatever else is going on here."
On the other hand, Lear was in heaven. He followed Commander Cherrystone around, unless he was turned back, and he fetched water for the men and polished their boots, in a surfeit of ill-concealed romance. The tramping they did, reconnoitering about the local valleys, mapping the places to ford the river, pinpointing spots for beacons, gave Lear more exercise and fresh air than he had ever had before. His spine, which had threatened to become curved like the arc of a mountain harp, seemed to straighten out. The soldiers were indifferent to him, but they were not manifestly unkind, and Lear took this as approval and fondness. The sisters regained some sense when they stopped to consider what class of men would go into the army, but it wasn't easy. Sarima alone seemed unperturbed by the disturbance to their routine. She cast about among the villagers and called in favors to help her feed the host of soldiers. And in mixed resentment and fear, her neighbors came up with milk, eggs, cheese, and vegetables. There was stouch or garmut from the fish well almost every evening, and the summer game, of course, quail, hill fennecs, baby rock, which the men proved a dab hand at bringing in themselves. Nanny suspected that the reconnaissance team was helping Sarima over her grief, bringing her back to the family table at least. But Elphaba was furious at them all. She and the commander had words every day. Elphi forbade him to allow Lear to tag along, and she forbade Lear himself to absolutely no effect.
Her first true motherly feelings were of incompetence and of being blithely ignored as inconsequential. She could not understand how the human race had ever managed to develop past a single generation. She continually wanted to strangle Lear as a means of saving him from smooth-talking father figures. As Elfie tried harder to ferret out the nature of his mission, with every sidestepping pleasantry, Commander Cherrystone grew more icy and polite. The one thing Elphaba had never been able to manage was a parlor manner, and this soldier of all people was a master at it. It made her feel as she had felt among the society girls at Crage Hall. "Pay those soldiers no mind, they'll go away eventually," said Nanny, who was at the time of her life when everything was either the final fatal crisis or a dismissible matter indeed. Sarima says that she has rarely seen any of the wizard's forces in the Vincas. This was always arid, lifeless, of little interest to the farmers and merchants of northern and eastern Oz. The tribes have lived here for decades, centuries, I suppose, with nothing but the occasional cartographer passing through and beating a quick retreat. Don't you think this suggests some sort of campaign in these parts? What else can it suggest? Look at how long it has taken these young men to recuperate from their overland trek, said Nanny. This is surely just a reconnaissance mission, as they say. They'll get their information and then leave. Besides, everyone is always telling me the whole damn place is swamped in snow or mud for 2/3 of the year. You're a worrier. You always were. The way you gripped the quadlings we used to proselytize, as if they were your own private dolls. How you went on when they were relocated or whatever. It used to trouble your mother no end, believe me. It's been well documented that the quadlings were being exterminated, and we were witnesses, said Elphaba strictly. You too, Nanny. I look after my young. I can't look after the world, said Nanny, quaffing a cup of tea and scratching Killyjoy's nose. I look after Lear, which is more than you do. Elphaba didn't think it worth her while to lambaste the old biddy. She flipped through the grimoire again, trying to find some small spell of binding with which she could close the castle gates against the men. She wished she had at least sat in on Miss Grayling's class in magic at school. "Of course, your mother was worried about you. She always was," said Nanny. "You were such an odd little thing, and the trials that poor woman had. You remind me of her now, only you're more rigid than she was. She could really let her hair down. Do you know, she was so upset with having you be a girl, she was so convinced you'd be a boy, she sent me to the Emerald City to find an elixir to ensure—" But Nanny stopped, muddled. "Or was that elixir to prevent her next child from being born green?" "Yes, that was it." "Why did she want me to be a boy?" said Elphaba. "I would have obliged her if I'd had a say in the matter. Not to be simplistic, but it always made me feel horrible to know how I'd disappointed her so early on. Not to mention the looks." "Oh, don't credit her with nasty motives," said Nanny. She eased her shoes off and rubbed the backs of her feet with her cane. "Melina had hated her life at Colwyn Grounds, you know. That's why she contrived to fall in love with Frex and get out of there. Her grandfather, the eminent Throp, had made it all too clear that she would inherit the title. The Munchkinlander title descends through the female line unless there are no daughters. The family seat and all its attendant responsibilities would go from him to Lady Partra to Melina, and then to the first daughter Melina had. She was hoping to have only sons, to keep them out of that place.
"'She always talked about it so lovingly,' said Elphaba, astounded. "'Oh, everything is gorgeous once it's gone. "'But for a young person trained up in all that wealth and responsibility, "'well, she hated it. "'She revolted by having sex early and often with anyone who would oblige, "'and she as good as ran off with Frex, "'who was the first suitor she had who loved her for herself "'and not her position and inheritance.' She thought a daughter of hers would find it equally deadly, so she wanted sons. But that makes no sense. If she had sons and no daughters, then her oldest son would inherit. If I'd been a boy without sisters, I'd still have been stuck in the same mess. Not necessarily, said Nanny. Your mother had one older sister who was born with a permanent case of overwrought nerves, maybe also lacking in the brains department. She was housed off grounds. But she was old enough to breed, and healthy enough, and was just as likely to bear a daughter. If she had borne a daughter first, her daughter would have inherited the title of eminence, and the estate and fortunes with it. "So I have a mad aunt," said the witch. "Maybe madness runs in the family. Where is she now?" "Died of the flu when you were still a small child and left no issue. So Melina's hopes were dashed. But that was her thinking back in those brash, brave days of youthful blunder." Elphaba had few memories of her mother, and they were warm, sometimes searing. "But what's this about her taking medicine to prevent Nessarose from being born green?" "I got her some tablets in the Emerald City from some gypsy woman," said Nanny. "I explained to the beastly creature what had happened. I mean that you'd been born an unfortunate color. And those teeth! Thank Lurleen, your second set were more human. And the gypsy woman made some silly prophecy about two sisters being instrumental in the history of Oz. She gave me some powerful pills. I've always wondered if the pills were the cause of Nessarose's affliction. I wouldn't mess with gypsy potions any more, believe me. Not with what we know these days." She smiled, having long ago forgiven herself of any culpability in the whole affair. "Nessarose's affliction," mused Elphaba. "Our mother took some gypsy remedy and bore a second daughter without arms. It was either green or armless. Mama didn't have very good luck at girls, did she? Shell, however, is a sight for sore eyes," said Nanny rosily. "Then who is to say it was all your mother's fault? First there was the confusion about who was really Nessarose's father, and then the pills from that old yackle person, and your father's moodiness." "Yackle person? What do you mean?" asked Elphaba, starting. "And who the hell was Nessarose's father, if it wasn't Papa?" "Oh, la," said Nanny. "Pour me another cup of tea, and I'll tell you all. You're old enough now, and Melina's long dead." She meandered through a story about the quaddling glassblower named Turtleheart, and Melina's uncertainty whether Nessarose was his child or Frex's, and the visit to Yackle, about whom she could remember nothing else but the name, the pills, and the prophecy. "Can't pull teeth from a hen, so stop trying." She didn't mention, and she never had, how depressed Melina became when Elphaba was born. There was no point. Elfie listened to all this, impatient and annoyed. On the one hand, she wanted to throw it out the window. The past was immaterial. On the other, things fell into a slightly different order now. And that Yackle, was the name just a coincidence? She was tempted to show Nanny the picture of Yackle snarling in the grimoire, but resisted. No sense alarming the old woman, or giving her the night-time frights. So the two women poured each other tea and restrained themselves from painful observations about the past. But Elphaba began to fret about Nessa Rose. Perhaps Nessie didn't want the position of eminence and was just as incarcerated there as her older sister was here. Perhaps Elphaba owed her the chance of liberty. Yet how much really could you owe other people? Was it endless? Nor was beside herself. In a short time her whole life had changed so utterly. The world was more magic than ever, but it seemed lodged inside her now, not outside. Her body was waiting to flame, to blossom, and no one seemed to care or to notice. Lear had become a water boy for the expeditionary soldiers. Irgi spent his time composing long devotional libretti in honor of Lurlina. In a state of uncertainty over the men in residence, the sisters remained confined to their chambers by their own inclination, yet quivering with readiness should things change. Nothing could change, as convention dictated, unless Sarima married again, and then they would be free to court. Their domestic campaigns to throw Commander Cherrystone and Sarima together, however, met with no success. They redoubled their efforts. Three even approached Auntie Witch for a love potion from that magic encyclopedia. "Ha!" said Elphaba. "That'll be the day." And that was that about that. Nor, bereft of companionship, took to hanging around the men's dormitory, trying to pitch in with chores that Lear wasn't asked to do, that men didn't much care about. She hung out their cloaks in the sun. She polished their buttons. She brought them flowers from the hills. She prepared a tray of summer fruits and cheeses that seemed to please them, especially when she served them herself. One young, dark, balding soldier, with a captivating smile, liked her to pop the orange segments right in his lips, and he sucked the juice from her fingers, to the mingled enjoyment and envy of the others. "Sit on my lap," he said, "and let me feed you." He offered her a strawberry, but she wouldn't sit on his lap, and she loved refusing. One day she decided to treat them to a full-scale chamber cleaning. They were out doing an inventory of the vineyards on the lower slopes and would be gone all day. Nor arrayed herself with rags, yoked herself with buckets, and since Auntie Witch was deep in conversation with Nanny about, it seemed, Sarima, Nor swiped the witch's broom for its thicker brush and longer handle. She headed to the barracks. She couldn't read much, so she ignored the letters and maps that spilled from the leathern satchels left carelessly slung over the back of a chair. She tidied the trunks and swept, and in the effort raised a lot of dust and felt warm. She took off her blouse and slung one of the men's rough capes over her sun-browned shoulders. It gave off such a heady aroma of maleness, even after its airing, that she nearly swooned. She lay down on someone's pallet with the cape just slightly falling open so that she could imagine falling asleep and having the men return and see the beautiful line of flat skin that ran between her fresh new breasts. She considered pretending to fall asleep, but she knew she wouldn't do this. She sat up, dissatisfied with the possibilities, and reached out to grab the nearest thing. It happened to be the broom, so she could whack something in frustration. The broom was out of reach, but it lunged a little toward her. It came across the floor of its own accord. She saw it. The broom was magic. She touched it almost fearfully, as if she guessed it had intentions. It felt no different from an ordinary broom. It merely moved, as if guided by the hand of an invisible spirit. "What tree are you whittled from? What field are you mown from?" She asked it, almost tenderly, but she expected no answer, and she got none. The broom quivered and elevated itself a little off the floor, as if waiting. The cape had a hood on it, and she drew this up over her face. Then she hiked her summer skirt to her knees and threw one leg over the broom to ride it as a child rides a hobby horse. The thing rose tentatively so she could keep her balance by trailing her toes on the floor, correcting, correcting. The center of gravity was high, and the span was so narrow. The top of the handle tilted farther up, and she slid down the shaft until she was caught against the brush top, as if it were a saddle of sorts. She held on tightly. Her legs, especially in the upper thigh, felt as if they were swelling, the better to clench the handle between them. The large window at the end of the room hung open for air and light, and the broom moved a couple of feet across the floor until it had reached the sill. Then the broom rose a few feet and carried her out the window. Nora's stomach pitched, and her heels beat against the underside of the brush. Mercifully, she had emerged not in the castle courtyard, where she would likely be seen, but on the other side, where the land did not fall away quite so far and fast. Nora wailed softly in the strangeness and ecstasy of the adventure. The cape flared out, exposing her chest, and how could she ever have imagined she wanted to be seen without a blouse? "Oh, oh!" she cried, but whether to the broom or to some guardian spirit she did not know. She shuddered with exposure and shock, and the broom rose higher and higher until it had come to a level with the uppermost window, which was in the witch's tower. The witch and her nanny were watching, open-mouthed, with cups of tea halfway to their lips. "You come down from there at once," ordered the witch. Nor didn't know if it was she who was being addressed or the broom. She had no reins to tug, no words of magic to wield. However, the broom, apparently chastened, turned back, descended, and made a somewhat clumsy landing on the floor of the men's barracks. Nora flung herself off, weeping and shivering, and reclothed herself properly. She didn't want to touch the broom again, but when she picked it up, the life had gone out of it, and she carried it up to the witch's apartments, expecting a severe reprimand. "What were you doing with my broom?" barked the witch.
"I was cleaning the soldiers' quarters," gabbled Nora. "It's such a mess, their papers all over, their clothes, their maps."
"Keep your hands off my things, you," said the witch. "What kinds of papers?"
"Plans, maps, letters, I don't know," said Nora, regaining her spunk. "Go look for yourself. I didn't pay attention."
The witch took the broom and appeared to consider hitting Nora with it. "Don't be a fool, Nora. Stay away from those men," she said coldly. "Stay away from them." She raised the broom like a truncheon. "They'll hurt you as soon as spit at you. Stay away from them, I say, and stay away from me."